You're listening to the Author Stories Podcast, bringing you the story behind the stories and the storytellers.
Margaret Wise,
Terry Brooks,
Sheena Kamal,
Matthew Quick,
J.T. Ellison,
Walt D. Williams,
Brad Ford,
Corey Doctorow, Brandon
Sanderson, Robin Mock,
Ernest Klein, Jim Butcher,
Sherilyn Harris.
Visit HankGarner.com for archives of all the shows. Today's guest is
Peter Doggett.
Thanks for tuning into Author Stories today. We've got a fantastic show coming up for you. As always, go to HankGarner.com where you can subscribe to the show on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher Radio, Spotify, YouTube, anywhere that you like to get your author interviews, you can find us there. I'd like to thank Aaron St. Pierre and Gwen White today for sponsoring this episode with their book, The Fire Thief. She fights to survive, but only white-hot rage will reveal her true power. Remembering the hope of the past helps Stasha endure her bleak present. Blaming herself for her best friend's injury, she brawls and steals to provide in a world run by Faye. But with an arranged marriage approaching, Stasha swipes two silvers in hope of their escape and erupts into a fiery burst of magic. Surprised and confused by power she can't possibly control, Stasha barely has time to register that her friend has been sent off to die. With time running out and no options left, she must put her faith in powerful strangers as they dive into a Fae skirmish for supremacy. Surrounded by dubious allies, her only hope to redeem her past is to mount an attack on an inescapable death camp. As Stasha fights to free her friend, the battle she's faced her whole life is about to become a war. The Fire Thief is the first book in an exhilarating high fantasy series. If you like gutsy heroines, elemental magic, and epic sword and sorcery action, then you'll love New York Times bestselling authors Aaron St. Pierre and Gwen White's Roller Coaster Tale. Buy The Fire Thief to unlock an ancient Fae destiny today. Also thanks to Patrice Fitzgerald and the Beyond the Stars Space Opera Anthology series. There are 5 volumes out, and a 6th one comes out this summer in the Beyond the Stars Space Opera Anthology series. Each release includes between 10 and 15 short stories, followed by a Q&A with the author. Some of the writers are New York Times and USA Today bestsellers. Some readers are saying, "It's a blisteringly good collection. These stories are full of great complex characters, not all of them human. Twists and turns and fantastic world building. Epic space battles, exotic aliens, far-flung planets. 15 fabulous tales that will thrill and surprise you, some chosen from previous Beyond the Stars volumes and some brand new, are in the Best Of collection. Come along as these award-winning authors sweep you along on adventures as broad as the universe and as deep as their imagination. The Beyond the Stars Space Opera Anthology series. Pick it up today. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I am really excited to have Peter Doggett on the show with me. He has a fantastic new book, CSNY, Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young. No other title necessary. This is the definitive book about the supergroup Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young, and it's all of that and so much more. If you are a music buff like I am, this is a must-have for your bookshelf. Welcome to the show, Peter.
Thanks very much. That's good to be here.
Peter, I begin each show with the same question, and that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
When I was about 5, and therefore I could read and I could just about write, I started writing my own versions of a show that was on the television in England, which was a kids show, obviously called Thunderbirds. I don't even know if it screened in America or not, but it was about international rescue, and these puppets had rockets, and they were going to save the world with them. And this was just so exciting to me that I think I learned to be a writer by writing extra stories for that show.
I love that. Were there any adults in your life, parents, teachers, or anything that recognized that you had this desire and maybe offered any encouragement?
I don't think anybody offered any direct encouragement beyond one or two teachers who would sort of say, well, that's good, you know, write another one. But nobody planted the seed ever that I might be a writer. I mean, I think it was only really in my teens that I started to think, oh, maybe I could actually do this as a life.
Right. Did you start considering, you said in your teens, what was the thing that made you start thinking that maybe this was something you could pursue?
I'm trying to avoid saying that I couldn't think of anything else I could do, but we'll leave that. Except I would love to have played sports for a living, but I wasn't good enough, unfortunately.
That's so many of our shared story right there. Yeah.
In terms of writing, I think when I was 15, 16, I discovered the works of F. Scott Fitzgerald. And this wasn't the first adult writer that I'd read by any means, but it was the first one where I identified with the voice. I think I read his first book first, This Side of Paradise. And there was just something about the voice that came off the page that I completely identified with, although I was nothing like him, or and my life was nothing like his. But it really spoke to me, and that thing of speaking is really important, I think, with so many authors, if you can actually hear the voice coming out of the book. And that made me think, well, I'd love to be able to do that. And I guess that was the seed of it all, really.
Well, speaking of voice, you have a very distinctive writing voice in the books that you produce. And I noticed this when reading CSNY, your new book. I've had it about a month or so. Your publisher's publicist sent it to me, and I immediately dug into it. And I kept thinking as I'm reading it, wow, this sounds like someone I know. And then I got to looking, and sure enough, you have written some of my favorite music biographies. You Never Give Me Your Money, which is, if you're a Beatles fan like I am, it's you know, again, kind of the definitive book on the breakup of the Beatles. And you know, I was born right as the Beatles were breaking up, and it's a really interesting look into that time and that time period, and the minds of you know, people that I respected so much my whole life. And then you know, you've also written you know, the biography of David Bowie, and then this other excellent book that I have, Are You Ready for the Country, which is this exploration of the intersection of American roots music and rock. And I was thinking, I know this person already, and you know, and my bookshelf is already lined with your books. And how did you come to find what would become your voice?
I think it was something that I was very lucky. I was almost born with it. I can remember back when I was at college and in the holidays, obviously we didn't have mobile phones. Our parents stopped us from using the landline because it costs money, and you can't speak to your friends. It's a waste of time, waste of money. And so you would write letters to people. I'm going way back to the 70s now. And I can remember really, really clearly when I was 18 or 19, getting a letter back from a friend who said, your letters are amazing. They sound just like you talking. And that had never struck me before. And it made me realize that I did have a distinctive voice. And now, obviously, as a professional writer, you don't always want to sound conversational. But I was aware of wanting my work always to sound like me.
You say that you don't want to sound conversational always as a professional writer, yet so many people would give their left arm to be able to pull that off so effortlessly the way you do.
Well, I really appreciate that as a compliment. I mean, I'm not just saying that, but that means a lot to me. Thank you. I guess when I say you don't always want to be conversational, if you're trying to get across hard facts sometimes,
of course,
maybe that's, you know, not necessarily the best way of doing it. But yes, the whole idea of the writer as somebody you can identify with, as a friend, particularly I think with nonfiction, which can be a very cold way of writing, if you can gather the reader in and make them feel wanted and part of the story, I think that's a great thing to do.
Sure. What was your first foray into journalism or journalistic pursuits, maybe?
When I was 22, I got a job with a small English magazine called Record Collector. which, as its name suggests, was first of all very much about records. This was entirely about popular music, and it really was for people who were obsessed about the small details of the whole history of rock and roll, pretty much. And so it was an ideal place for me because I was that obsessed person as well. And so that was a lesson for me in having to communicate really dense factual information and make it readable. So I think in terms of writing books later, it was actually a really good apprenticeship.
What was, and everything of yours that I've read, it focuses on the music industry and these particular people in the music industry. What's your first memory of a piece of music, a record, a performance, whatever the old cliche that, you know, you hear something and it changes your life. Do you have one of those moments that was a lightning rod moment for you?
I guess also going back to when I was 5 or 6 and hearing the Beatles and the Dave Clark Five. Now, if you've ever heard the Dave Clark Five's early records, they're guaranteed to appeal to boys of 5 and 6 because they just make you want to hit things and stomp your feet. So that was perfect. I lost interest in music until I was about 13, which was 1970, and then discovered it again. And one of the first records I bought was the first John Lennon solo album, John Lennon Plastic Ono Band. And we were talking earlier about the power of the individual voice. And with that album, we're talking about John Lennon's voice, not just as a singer, but as a songwriter as well, expressing all this agony and pain, which for a tortured adolescent, I just felt right at home. You know, he was speaking to me, and then beyond that, in a more sophisticated way, I would think the entire catalogue of Bob Dylan. I'm still pretty obsessed with Dylan. I think he's a remarkable songwriter, almost an even better singer, which people don't give him credit for, and. I think it's remarkable, again, with his voice, that he can express the deepest emotions with just a howl or a croon. And
right. Well, in a society obsessed with auto-tune and quote musical perfection to the point of being imperfect, having that raw emotion really kind of hits you on a soul level, the way that kind of canned, laptop-made music could never do.
I agree, and obviously I'm showing my age by
me too.
sadly, but I love improvisational music. I love music where it sounds, whether it's live or on record, where it sounds as if something might happen which the musicians aren't quite sure about. So I would much rather go and see a band if they were still going, like the Grateful Dead, for example, where you might get chaos or you might get genius, rather than see somebody whose entire show is programmed already in the computer.
When you may get genius, you may get chaos all within the span of 5 minutes.
Yeah.
You never know.
And I've already mentioned Bob Dylan. I mean, he is the absolute example of that.
And you know what? I was listening to some Dylan in the car with my kids last night, and the crazy thing is his catalog is so deep and expansive, and I'm still discovering things, 30 years later of kind of being obsessed with Dylan. It's kind of crazy.
Yeah, and it's extremely kind of Sony to supply us with a Christmas present every year with a new thing.
Whether we deserve it or not, there it is. Oh, so you go to work at Record Collector. What did that do for expanding the way you saw music, thought of music, and what was it that made you want to communicate what you were feeling about music?
Music is one of the great passions of my life, always will be, always has been, at least since I was 13. And rather than being the kind of music journalist who takes great pleasure in trashing other people's careers and other people's work, I wanted to convey that passion. I wanted other people to share it. I wanted to try and explain why I was feeling that way. And so I loved the fact that I was writing for a magazine where I could do that, where I could actually say, okay, well, here's this CD by somebody you've probably never heard of, but if you listen to track four, there is something that might change your life. That was really my sort of ethos was. So when it came to music, my big joy was to be able to convert other people so that they could start to hear what I could hear. So I used to be thrilled if I wrote something. It might just be an album review that was one paragraph long. But if somebody said, it sounded so fantastic, that record, I went out and bought it, then I was delighted.
That brings up a great thing to talk about, the idea of criticism, whether it be music criticism, book criticism. We get sent lots and lots of books from publishers, and some of them I absolutely adore. Some of them just aren't for me. Some of them I can see where other people would really connect with and like it. But I think it's just okay. I would much rather talk about things that I absolutely love than to trash what someone else has worked so hard to accomplish. How do you juggle those two things with giving an honest representation of your experience with something, and then also honoring what someone has put into it? And is there ever a line that you cross where this is just horrible, and I have to tell people it's just horrible? How do you deal with walking that line?
I always try and remember to be honest, rather than thinking this is going to be good for my career. If I really trash this new album by, I don't know, Jay-Z or somebody, I'm going to get retweeted and retweeted. I'm not interested in doing that. All I'm interested in doing is providing my honest appraisal of something, and perhaps helping other people to see a record or a book in a different light.
You have you've been at a vantage point to watch the evolution of the music industry, and from the early days of records, I can remember buying 45 singles. When I was a kid, I remember having 78s. Around, they predated me by a little bit, but my parents bought 78s. I bought 45s. I bought full albums. I remember buying cassette tapes and my parents having 8 tracks, and through CDs, and then now to digital music, and then now back to vinyl, and coming full circle. You have chronicled the progression of kind of the music delivery systems as well in some of your work. How do you feel like the music industry has changed because of the technology and the way that we consume music now?
Well, it's funny you asked me that question, because I wrote a whole book about it.
I have it on my shelf.
we should tell people it's called Electric Shock, and it's actually just about my favorite of all the books I've done. I mean, obviously, I love CSNY, the new one as well, but I'm particularly passionate about Electric Shock because it allowed me to tell the story of popular music right from the birth of commercial sound, recorded sound back in the 1890s, all the way through until the birth of streaming and whatever in recent years. And the thing I noticed, there were two major lessons I learned when I was doing the book. The first of which was that each time a technology changes, the music changes. And sometimes it's the technology taking the lead. On other occasions, the guys who are making the equipment are struggling to keep up with the vision of the musicians. So that was lesson number one. And lesson number two, which absolutely amazed me when I realized it, was that every new form of popular music since ragtime in the 1890s has been greeted as an abomination by the older generation. And so you can go through music history for 125 years and find people of my age, you can find middle-aged, elderly people, politicians, ministers, educators, all howling in appalled disgust at the latest disgusting kind of popular music, which if we then hear 20, 30 years later, it sounds like the mildest thing going, like, you know, the Charleston or something. I always remember my father, when I was in my teens, shouting up the stairs at me about turning that terrible noise down. And my grandmother, who was staying, came up to see me and said, "Don't take it too hard." When I was 20, 21, my father took me aside and said, "The Charleston is the most appalling, awful dance that's ever been created, and I don't want you ever to dance it." And that lesson stayed with me.
Oh, that's so funny. I often lament the loss of the way that we used to consume albums. I remember going to the record store back when there were record stores and buying a new album and bringing it home, you know, taking the cellophane off, carefully taking out the LP, putting it on the record player, putting the needle down. It's this whole visceral experience, and hearing the crackle, you know, as you put the headphones on it and you listen to it with good headphones, and you lay down on the floor holding the record jacket as the music comes on. And I remember my first experience with Sgt. Pepper's, with Dark Side of the Moon, with any number of records, and you listen to it while studying, you know, trying to figure out who all these people were on the album jacket of Sgt. Pepper's, and it was a whole experience, and you listen to it all the way through. And albums are rarely created that way anymore. Now we're you know, creating singles, you know, and that can be downloaded from iTunes and that sort of thing. How has the modern delivery method changed the way music is being made?
It's made music, or at least commercial music, have to be much more immediate. There's much less room for subtlety, which is not a criticism, it's just an observation, in that everybody's attention span, including mine, including yours, right down to small kids, is so small these days that there are so many claims on our time and on our attention that if you can't grab people in the first 2 or 3 seconds of a record with a beat or whatever it is, or a hook of some kind, then the listener's going to go, "Nah, next, next, next." So everything now has to be immediate. It has to hit you over the head with the groove or whatever. And so I think that's a shame in terms of I really liked a more sophisticated kind of popular music, but maybe that doesn't fit in the 21st century.
Well, the same thing has happened with books. If you look at fiction, Lord of the Rings, which, you know, really came into its own late 50s and 60s, you could not, I don't think you could publish that book today to the same reception. Nothing happens for 50 pages. And now, when you open a book like that, you need to drop the reader right into the action, and then you can go back and you can do some scene setting after that. But it's the evolution of the listener and reader, I guess, that we're seeing more than anything. Maybe it's shortened attention spans, but it seems to be pervasive in all of media.
That's true. I mean, I always love to think my favorite author is an American who came to live in England, Henry James. And there are plenty of Henry James's books where the first sentence lasts a paragraph, or it lasts 15 lines, you know. Right. And the idea that anybody in the 21st century who doesn't either already love him or doesn't have to read him for an assignment of some kind is going to bother to get all the way through those perfectly modulated, balanced paragraphs, long rambling sentences. I just don't think people in the future are going to have time for that.
Yeah. And you know, I guess like you said, not a criticism, just an observation. That's the reality, and we're just along for the ride, watching as it happens, I guess. What was your first long form piece that you did? You started writing reviews and things like that. When did you really start getting into biographies and digging into these people's lives to a point where you could tell a story like no one else has?
Let me think. Well, I had a few secret identities in the 1980s and early 1990s that I won't bore you with. Nobody knows about them but me, and I shall carry their secret to the grave, probably. But around 1990, under a pseudonym, I wrote a book about John Lennon called The Art and Music of John Lennon. And although it was, how would you describe it, fragmentary, because it was a chronological survey of his life and work, and each set of recordings or each bit of writing had its own entry. It was the first time that I constructed something that was over 100,000 words and which had to hang together and tell a story, despite being broken up into fragments. So that was my first real book, I guess. And then I wrote a biography of Lou Reed, purely based on archive research, no interviews at all, for a small publisher in England. And then after that, you've already mentioned the book, Are You Ready for the Country? That was at the end of the 90s, which was a foolhardy attempt to try and bring together all the different connections between rock music and country music over the course of about 50 years.
Well, foolhardy maybe, but as someone who grew up in the American South and was kind of raised on, you know, country music and American roots music, and who was a lover of rock music and grew up there kind of in this tension between the two, it was an amazing story for me. What was the inspiration for that for you?
I had started going to Nashville in the early 1990s, just at the point when there was a real renaissance in slightly roots-based country. You had artists like Travis Tritt and Randy Travis and who else? Clint Black, all these kind of people coming out who at least showed their allegiance to country roots in a way that the previous generation of country pop singers hadn't done. And it was a great time to be in Nashville. It was great fun and heard all sorts of wonderful music. And it was an immediate connection for me with the music I'd grown up with in the 70s, which was the Byrds and the Flying Burrito Brothers, Bob Dylan, the Grateful Dead, which also had a big country influence. And so I started to sort of tease out all the different connections, and then going backwards back to Hank Williams and through Elvis and Jerry Lee and all those guys, and then right the way through to the birth of the Americana industry as well. And then I tried to drag it all together into one book.
When you kind of conceive of a project like that, how do you go about getting something like that published? When you say, I have an idea, I would like to connect American country music with a lot of these British bands that had these roots influences, and all the way through Dylan. How do you get a publisher excited for something like that?
It's not always a question I can answer, unfortunately. But in that instance, I persevered. I mean, I came up with the idea, I guess, around 93, 94, and it wasn't published until 99. And I didn't get my publishing deal till 97, I think. I'd already been turned down by two or three of the major UK publishers. But a friend of mine who was being published at the time by Viking, he said, let me talk to my editor. And he showed me, he showed the editor my proposal. And then I got a phone call from the editor saying, I understand we need to publish your book. And that was it. That was my sort of into the big league. So I was published by Penguin, which was very exciting for me.
That is very exciting. Did having that book published, did it open doors to be able to pursue other interests, to dig into other stories? Are you ever approached with ideas like, Peter, we would like for you to write a book about David Bowie, which I think I understand that you were sort of handed that project in a way.
I sort of was. I had done a book for the Bodley Head in Britain and for HarperCollins in America, which you mentioned earlier. You Never Give Me Your Money, about the breakup of the Beatles and the awful aftermath of it over the next 30, 40 years. And the editor of that book in London was the same guy who had edited Ian MacDonald's Revolution in the Head, which I know is many, many people's favorite book about the Beatles. And at the time Ian unfortunately took his own life, he was writing a similar book about David Bowie. And so it just came up in conversation with the editor in London. It just came up, and he said, "Would you be interested in having a look to see how much of the book Ian wrote?" And I said, "Well, if he's written 90% of it, we might be able to sort of, you know, help to finish it off in some way if he's still got his research material." And anyway, the editor went off, approached Ian's family, and came back and discovered he hadn't actually written a word of the book. But by that time, I got excited. I'd gone away for a weekend and listened to nothing but all the David Bowie albums in chronological order. And I'd managed to forget up to that point how wonderful these records were. I mean, I loved them at the time, but for various reasons, I had stopped listening to him. And to spend that weekend...
Well, probably because of the 80s.
Yeah, quite possibly. So, yeah. So to have that reminder of how great his 70s work was, that even though the editor came back and said, "Well, sorry, there is no book for you to finish off," I said, "I don't care. I want to do this book myself," which is how I ended up writing The Man Who Sold the World.
Which is a fantastic piece. How do you, when you start researching a book like that, or like You Never Give Me Your Money, which is my personal favorite, I like it a lot better than Revolution in the Head, because you dare to try to give us a glimpse into what the Beatles were going through, which was kind of a brave thing to do. And I think some people take exception to the way that you wrote that, but I really enjoy the way that you did that. How do you start, you know, when we're dealing with people that everyone knows, and that people believe they know better than they do? You know, everyone has these ideas about who John Lennon was, or who Paul McCartney is, or who, you know, George Harrison, or you know, in any number. How do you go about finding information that is new to people while being as you know, as true to the source as you can be?
Yeah, and obviously that's exactly the challenge I've just faced with the book on Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young again. In each of those instances, I'm only doing the book because I love the artists, I love their music. So first of all, I wouldn't be doing this if it was about a band in whom I had no personal interest. I really enjoyed doing really detailed research. So in the case of the David Bowie book, that meant soaking myself in the music to the point of actually learning to play all the songs myself, either on the piano or the guitar, so I could hear and to try to work out what David Bowie was doing when he put the songs together. Oh, he's learning to play the piano. So, okay, he's got one finger in the left hand and he's got just playing three chord, you know, triad chords in the right. That's interesting. And then you could see how he could feel his way towards writing a song. So that was what happened with the Bowie book. With something like the Beatles, I already had several boxes of research material because it was a book I'd been sort of vaguely thinking maybe one day I would write. And I was a huge fan, so I had all this ridiculous information stored away in my brain. And the same with the CSNY. And then you try and take all that information, unearth as much stuff from the past that people haven't seen, because it hasn't been reprinted, it hasn't been endlessly mined in the same in the way that the Rolling Stone archive has been, for example. So that you've got a pretty good historical canvas, and then, well, I found it interesting. I trained a few years ago, although I don't work in this field, but I trained as a humanistic counselor in transactional analysis, which was life-changing for me, but it also altered the way in which I see, what's the phrase, group dynamics, or the way people interact with each other. And both when I was writing this CSNY book and with the Beatles book as well, I suddenly found I had extra insight into, in the case of the Beatles, you've got Paul McCartney endlessly trying to push the others on, and you can see how the others are reacting against that. And so the thing you mentioned earlier about some people not liking the way I almost try and read into their minds, you can get a very real sense of how people are feeling about each other by the things they say to each other and also the things they don't say. And so I found that's given me a whole sort of extra layer when I'm writing these books of appreciating the people, not just as stars, but as human beings.
How much access do you get, if any, to the people that are still with us? Obviously, when you're dealing with the Beatles breakup, there's lots and lots of published material. And with CSNY, there's lots of published material again. But we have the added benefit of these guys still being here. How do you weigh what they think of their own story with the things that are known to us and available to us?
Well, one of the big problems of writing about guys like CSNY who were in their 70s and who led very exciting lives, let's put it that way, in the 60s and 70s, experimenting with substances that might not help their memories, is that they have not necessarily got the best grasp on details of what happened and why things happened.
And so that's a very good point. I haven't even considered that wrinkle.
So when I came to write the book on CSNY, I'd already interviewed Crosby, Stills and Nash several times over quite a few years. So I had a lot of material I could draw on. I'd already spoken to lots of the people they'd worked with as well, Joni Mitchell, other members of the Hollies, the Byrds, and so on. Ahmet Ertegun, the guy who signed CSNY to Atlantic Records, their original drummer, Dennis Taylor. So I had a huge archive of my own personal interviews, which I gathered since the 80s. But I knew from the start that I didn't want to write the kind of book where somebody goes out today and tries to get people who are in their 70s to remember accurately what happened 50 years ago. What I always say is that the passage of time can be really good in terms of your perspective, but it's absolutely hopeless when it comes to detail. And in fact, in the very last small chapter of the CSNY book, I write about this. I write about memory in relation to each of Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young, either drawing on personal instances where they've told me things that were completely untrue because they've misremembered, or to published occasions where they've said, look, I really can't remember. One of the big debates between Crosby, Stills and Nash is, when did these three guys first sing together? It was in 1968, that much we know. And I'm fairly certain, 95% certain, that it was actually at Joni Mitchell's house, although they might have sung together at Mama Cass's house or at Stephen Stills' house 6 months earlier, but not as a trio. I was overjoyed to discover during my research that as early as December 1968, in an interview, CSNM were already fighting about where they first sung together. Now, this is probably less than 4 months after they'd done it, and they can't remember.
Oh, that's amazing.
Probably high at the time, and had been high nonstop ever since as well.
Right.
So their short-term memory was already not really very reliable. So for them, or anybody else for that matter, to then turn around 50 years later and say, I remember it as if it was yesterday. Well, you feel as if you remember it, but absolutely none of us remember 50 years ago accurately. So I did not want to write a book that was entirely full of people trying to remember what happened 50 years ago and getting it wrong.
Wow. In the introduction to the book, you give us kind of your experience with Crosby, Stills, and Nash and Young, and you know, why and when you began to love them. And you reminded me in there that they only did a couple of dozen songs, recorded a couple of dozen songs. Many of them, though, are kind of in our collective consciousness of these are songs I've heard my entire life and have sung along with and kind of have been in the background soundtrack to my life. When you're writing a book like this, and this group have a definitive start, even though it's hard to pin down, as you just enumerated for us, How do you pick the what the book is going to encompass? A lot of your books cover a specific period in an artist's life or in their career. It's easy to pick a beginning point for this book. But how do you decide where the story is?
Well, as you say, CSN and then CSNY, each unit recorded one album, one in 69 and 1970. So they were basically together as a four-piece for about 12 months, and that was it.
That is crazy.
Yep, and then there's 3 or 4 years when everybody's talking, including them, about, are we going to get together? They almost get together. They guest at each other's shows. Then they fall out. Then they get together. And then they do the epic tour in 1974 of stadiums right across America. And then it ends up with one show in London. And then they split up. And although they try occasionally to get back together over the next decade, their hearts really aren't in it. And it's only in the late 80s, after David Crosby has been to prison and come out again, that Neil Young agrees to offer him a reward, if you like, for cleaning up his act, which is we'll get CSNY back together. But in my brain, much as I'd loved going to see CSNY in Dallas in 2002, one of the great nights of my life, it's not the same band. It's not a functioning band of equals. In the 70s, that there were four uniquely talented, uniquely arrogant, and uniquely charismatic guys who managed to just about stay together long enough to make music. Once David Crosby's been to prison and come out again, he's back, but it's not an equal band anymore. It's Neil Young deciding everything. Who's going to be in the band? What songs they're going to play? Are we going to do another tour? Well, it's up to me, and no, I don't want to do it, so it doesn't happen. So in terms of the main focus of the book, I decided I was going to write about the first year when they were together, the reunion tour, the period in between, and equally important to me, the 4 or 5 years that took each of them from the start of their careers in pop music and actually brought them together. I was able to trace all the ways in which their paths interacted. So, as I was saying earlier about the Beatles, trying to establish them as four individuals, as four people with human flaws and enormous virtues artistically as well, and to bring them together gradually, to see them sort of tentatively trying the relationship out. Okay, this works, but what if we get this other guy in? No, it's going to ruin it. We'll try it. Oh, that works as well. Okay. And then within 9 months, they're not talking to each other.
But it's so weird that the power dynamics really mean everything in a musical collaboration like that. And we've seen story after story of a band that really begins as a band of brothers, all in together, all for one, creating this amazing stuff. And then one person gets involved in substances and then is given an ultimatum from the rest of the band. And then that person is no longer an equal member, but they're a probationary member. And then not only do the power dynamics of the band and the way the machinery functions, but inevitably it changes artistically as well. We know that these four guys come from, some of the biggest musical groups of the 60s and with the Byrds and Buffalo Springfield. And who am I forgetting? Buffalo Springfield, the Byrds, and
the Hollies.
The Hollies. How could I forget the Hollies? And
they were absolutely huge in Britain. Not so huge in the States.
Right. Well, they're huge on oldie stations in the U.S. So they got their due a little late here for whatever reason. But yeah, and so these guys, and then you bring Neil Young in, also from Springfield, but he has this sort of punk attitude that he brings to CSNY. Which then later becomes, he goes from, this punk to this domineering role. How do you, and what interests me about this book is that you treat them all four fairly in that you show all sides of them, the good, the bad, the ego, the brilliance, all of it. Is that ever a conscious thing that you're going through in that, I I went softly on Stephen here. I need to make sure that I tell the truth here, or, you know, or whatever. Is that ever, are you ever taking accounting of how the story is told as it's going?
Yes, I'm not sure that at any point I would have been soft on one of them, but I'm aware that it's very easy to all pile in if everybody is already blaming Paul McCartney for breaking up the Beatles, or Stephen Stills for being the most difficult member of CSNY in 1970. But I wanted to take a step back and go, look, they've got a voice as well. They've got a point of view. They're not just acting blindly. They're following, they're trying to do the best for the band. It just, they're doing it in a way that doesn't chime with everybody else. And so I think if you remember, each of those people are human beings with feelings. And there was no rule book for these guys. I mean, there was no, they couldn't go to the library and borrow How to Be Big in the Music Business and Stay Friends, because there were no books like that. Even their managers weren't really involved in sort of helping them to heal as a band. So you've got all these egos colliding off each other, and with the help of various substances, which, you know, might alter their moods at various times, it's an absolute recipe for chaos. And the other thing that everybody always forgets is how young these guys are. I mean, the Beatles, at the time they break up, George Harrison's only 26, 27 when they break up. With CSNY, they're having all these huge fights. They've got all this power in terms of finance and culture and so on. And Stephen Stills and Neil Young are both born in 1945. So when CSNY break up, they're 25 years old. Now, I know when you're 25, you think you're pretty damn old. But, you know, once you get to my age, you start to realize you're still finding your way. You're still trying to work out who you are. You haven't learnt how to deal with other people in that way. So that's where I think the fairness comes in. You have to be aware that they're human beings and they're struggling. They're trying to make the best out of it.
What's really interesting is that all of these guys had had careers before CSNY, and all of them still have careers after. What's unique is that they probably never were as popular individually as they ever were as CSNY, and to have had such a small body of work, that really has left an indelible, you know, imprint on us as music appreciators. Do you think they recognize that they are bigger and arguably better together than they ever were alone?
Absolutely. I mean, if you talk to David Crosby, one of the things he says is that if there's 100 people who want to go and see him, then maybe there's 300 who want to go and see him when he plays with Graham Nash, or when they were still speaking to each other. And then suddenly, oh, it's 3,000 if it's Crosby, Stills and Nash. And then you add Neil in there and suddenly you need a stadium. So it's very much the combination. So I'm sure they are all very much aware of that. And it's a fantastic blessing. Why would it not be? But at the same time, it's a curse, because you are faced, if you're one of Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young, and you're going out and doing a radio interview, at some point somebody is going to say, when are CSNY getting back together? And you can't escape that.
As we talked earlier about that unique voice that you write from, in this book, CSNY, you again walk that fine line of being conversational in a way that it feels like you and I are talking about a band that we love. And also being the voice of expertise, who's telling me things that I never knew and giving me insight that I didn't have. As you're writing in the first draft of the book, are you thinking about things like that? Like, okay, this is where I need to come across as, you know, in this way, I need to be more informative here. Or are you just getting through the quote unquote story of it to then go back and make those edits? What is the first draft writing a piece like this like?
I think I'm fortunate in having worked as a magazine journalist for many, many years. I am able to turn out a first draft of anything that is readable, that makes sense, that hangs together, that coheres. So I don't think there are many occasions where we, even with a book like this, when I've had to go back and say I haven't been fair to one or the other of them. I will go back and edit endlessly to try and get all every sentence as tight as possible and to make sure they have a rhythm that flows and to make sure that you can read it and not be stumbling over it. And obviously to make sure factually it's correct. But in terms of the actual the sort of balance between the musicians and so on, I think I do that instinctively rather than consciously.
The how long did it take to put this book together?
It's something like 120,000 words, and the actual writing, I mean, I'm lucky, I'm working from home, I don't have to do a day job. The actual writing was probably 4 or 5 months, something like that. But the research before that was a good 18 months. And that obviously doesn't count all the years of listening to their records and all the interviews I'd accumulated. But as a comparison, the previous book I wrote, Electric Shock, about the history of popular music, that took 4 or 5 years, most of which was research.
Oh, well, speaking of that, how much did you ever have to worry about the technology changing out from under you while trying to document the changing technology when writing that book?
Absolutely. In the case of CSMY, because I'm going back and looking at interviews that I've done since the 80s, well, they're all on old PCs, you know, old
right.
Laptops. And yeah, there is one laptop I can't kick into life. I mean, it's an Apple iMac, but it's the one before the internet, you know. So that I'm sure there is interview stuff on there, but most of it, when I got the next one, which I could go online with, I copied across. But there were one or two interviews where I was going, I know I spoke to so-and-so in 1987, but I do not have that interview anywhere. I've probably got a tape, a cassette tape somewhere in a bag or a box.
Wow.
But knowing me, I almost certainly wouldn't have written on the outside of the tape what it was. I just did it, transcribed it onto a computer I can no longer get into. And it's gone. So the lesson is, if you're ever going to do that kind of work, write everything down, print everything off, keep it.
Right. And your digital stuff, store it in a format that can be read later.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. I spoke with Cory Doctorow a year or so ago, and he was talking about that he makes a point to save everything as plain text because he never wants to be in the place where something that was written in a word processor that's no longer supported is unable. I think that's a practical thing to consider, especially when you're doing lots of archival work like you're doing. Make sure that you can access your documents later.
Yeah, exactly. Because if you don't do that, then every 3, 4, 5 years, suddenly that whole chunk of your career is gone forever.
Have you had any input from the band as the book is out now?
No. Well, I've certainly received nothing, but then I try really hard not to Google myself. I don't do social media, I'm afraid to say. I don't look at Amazon reviews, at least for the first year after a book comes out. So for all I know, they're all over the internet saying what a terrible writer I am, and I know nothing. But if they have said that, nobody's told me about it. That's the way I like it.
That's right. That's right. Well, Peter, I am a massive fan of everything that you do. It's been such a great pleasure to talk with you. If people want to dig into your back catalog and find out all the stuff that you've done and maybe follow along with new news coming up, is there a place that they can connect with you?
Well, I do have a website, which is peterdoggett.org, but it's in the process of construction. But at least it will give you some idea as to the books I've been writing over the last 20 years or so.
Excellent. The new book, CSNY, Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, this is the definitive collection if you're a CSNY fan or a fan of music in general. This is a fantastic book. I'm going to send everyone to get their copy of it. Peter, it's been so much fun talking to you. Thank you for taking time to come on the show today.
It's been great. I've really enjoyed it, Hank. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the show. Go to hankgarter.com to subscribe. Now stay tuned for a special audiobook clip from Master of Hounds from C. Stephen Manley.
He met Clint's eyes for the first time, and for an instant they flared with a dark violet light, like something you'd see lighting up fluorescent paints in a nightclub. Clint gasped suddenly despite himself and took another few steps back. He turned to run, blood bag scraping along behind him, when a chorus of howls from the floors below brought him up short. He stopped and looked around, fighting hard to keep his fear under control. "Be glad you parked near the top," the man said. "I told my hounds to start at the bottom and work their way up, while I came in from above. If you'd encountered them instead of me, you'd be in pieces by now." Clint was sure he could make it to either the stairwell that would lead him back inside or the elevator that would take him down to the garage's ground level. He'd have to stop at either, though, whether to try and pull a door open or wait for the elevator car. He glanced to the side as flashes of police robes started lighting up the night beyond the parking deck and sirens grew louder. He heard the distant chop-chop of a helicopter's rotors. "Don't get your hopes up," the man said. "All the pickmen are dead, and my hounds will make short work of the police. You're trapped, son. Face it like a man." Clint thought it over for a second before he realized that the man was right. No matter which way he went, he would get run down before he had a chance to get clear. There was no way out, and that meant there was only one thing left to do. He drew in a deep breath, knelt, and placed the patient on the floor as gently as he could. Fear-driven breath hissed around his teeth as he turned and faced the man in the stained suit. "I'm not your son," he said, meeting the other's eyes and planting his feet. The man's eyebrows rose in surprise. "Excuse me?" Clint swallowed hard. "You heard me, Slim. I'm not your son, and if you're looking to hurt this guy, well, we have a problem if that's the case." The man's eyes had grown wide with disbelief as Clint had been talking. After a moment, a wide smile crossed his face. "Let me make sure I understand," he said, holding up a hand for Clint to wait. "You've met my hounds. You just saw me throw that female around like she was a lawn dart, and now you're standing between me and my prey, even though it's obvious from your face that you have no earthly idea what I am or what you're actually facing. Have I got that all right?" Clint swallowed again. His mouth was as dry as a desert wind. "I think that about sums it up." The dark light flared through the man's eyes again, and tiny arcs of the same colored electricity danced over his hands. "Give me the pickmen," the man said, his voice suddenly more animal than man. Clint's stomach tightened as his guts went cold. For just an instant, he almost ran, but the moment passed, and he shifted his hands and feet into a defensive stance. He forced himself to hold the other man's blacklight stare as he shook his head. Suddenly, the lights were gone from the man's eyes as though they'd never been there. "Really?" he said. "Usually that little display sends you humans running like rabbits. It's been decades since anyone stood up to me like this. Why would you? You must recognize that I can kill you as easy as sliding off a horse. Why would you risk that for someone you've just met? He can't possibly be anything to you." "He's my patient," Clint said, forcing the words past the lump in his throat. "He's mine to look after until he's well. That, and I made a promise. Besides, you said it yourself. I'm boxed in here. If this is where I go out, then I'm sure as hell not going to do it running." The man studied Clint through narrowed eyes, his smile dropping into a thoughtful line. "You would die for a promise. Son, that makes you a rarity in today's world." He raised a finger to his lips absently, as though considering his options, and then said, "I'll tell you what. Since you've shown some obvious courage, I'll make you a deal. You walk away unmolested by either myself or my hounds. Gone, free and clear to live out as long a life as you can manage. Only you, though. The Pickman stays with me." Even Clint was surprised by how fast he replied. "No deal, freak show. This man's under my protection. The man with the blacklight eyes shook his head thoughtfully. A rarity indeed, he said. It's very nearly a shame to kill you. The man studied him a moment longer, then shrugged and said, Oh well, omelets and eggs. Energy flared around his hands and he thrust them toward Clint. Clint saw the hands coming up, the dark energy crackling between them. At the same time, though, he felt someone grab his ankle from behind. Warmth, like walking from a cold room into a hot summer day, flooded through him. At the same moment, searing pain seemed to light up his chest and head. For an instant, everything went dark. He felt as though he were being shredded apart from the inside out and pulled into a trillion molecule-sized lines that stretched out into a black forever. He had no throat to scream with, or eyes to weep with, or limbs to defend himself with. For that instant, he was little more than a stain of pain and terror stretched across the world. Then, the instant was over. Clint didn't feel himself fall, didn't feel the concrete bite into his face, didn't hear the sobbing scream that rushed from his throat. In those last instants before the darkness came for him again and his vision was clear, all he saw was his patient rising to his feet and stepping past him.